was the U.S. This particular line over here, which is the second most affected area, and then of course China and the emerging markets. The way we looked at this is with 100, that number to equal the most disrupted, and it's pretty clear, as you just saw there, that Europe was most affected. Now let's take a look at here, the EU and supply chain in particular, since we said they're the ones that were most affected. You can see from the year 2010, pretty much moderate, and they fluctuated between 40 and 50 roughly. But then when you come to the year, obviously 2020 is where you see the drop there. And in terms of the way that we looked at this, manufacturing PMI, suppliers' delivery times, is how this was listed and then pinpointed. And based on the note made by PMI, the readings above 50 indicate faster delivery times. Readings at 50 signal no change, and the readings below 50 indicate slower. So if you go to 50, obviously the downfall there, or the dip that it takes there, the negative point, is between the years 2020 and 2021, of which you can see European Union and the United States. So you get an idea of how bad they were hit there. Let's move on now to get an idea from this case, factory owner. We figured that's a good place to start. In particular, we looked at the owner in Germany, who paints a picture of how vast of a problem the supply chain disruption was for his business in Germany. Don't forget, Germany is a European powerhouse, but obviously they've been hit by the supply chain crisis. So from the factory owner to average everyday people who are paying the price on two fronts, either not having their product on the supermarket shelf or paying a higher price as a result of inflation. This particular person, however, an everyday person, knows quite a bit about the supply chain and the crisis that it's involved in.
But I think it's due to that disruption to the supply chains, because some factories need to let people get kind of well, take sick time off to recover from COVID. Maybe that means there's less people working in factories at the same time, and then there's just not enough output. I think also access to like raw materials was mentioned. I saw that on the news as well, that it's one of the reasons. It's just harder to produce things, and probably distribution is also worse, so some produce might get wasted before it even gets to the customers.
Okay, you heard from an everyday person there. All right, let's figure out some analysis into all of these different scenarios. Joining us here is Dust James. He's a truck driver from rural North Carolina who rejoins us. Dust James, welcome back. Taking a look at the Canada truck protest to have hit, and obviously the crisis that caused in terms of the cross-border trade between the U.S. and Canada. But we're also looking at how it brought into light the supply chain crisis. Much of it is focused when it comes to supply chain crisis at ports, warehouses, and retailers. What supply chain links are leading to the chaos, in your opinion?
Yes, that's another good question. And I can come back with a bit of an anecdotal response, but I leave to be representative of the larger system. I'm a truck driver. I've driven all 48 states. I've driven in Canada. Recently, I took a local job delivering snacks and food to local convenience stores. And that has been the model of business for convenience stores. There is a small regional distributor that gets those snacks and foods to those convenience stores.
Okay, Larry Friss is an adjunct professor of economics. He rejoins us to tell us what he thinks. Larry Friss, taking a look at major brands, traditionally they're shipped from factories around the world and also obviously from the warehouses that supply retail outlets, e-commerce demands, etc. Retailers must deliver individual orders to homes and businesses. How much of a problem is this lack of warehouses? Is it as big as they have made it out to be?
Hello. The warehouse issue is really one that is not as it may have been reported, and I'll tell you why. Warehouses were largely emptied as supplies were distributed to various retailers across the country. And so those warehouses are largely available to receive goods for further distribution. The problem is that they're not getting product as quickly as they normally would.
The blockades in Canada, which spread to the U.S., New Zealand, Australia, and France, have highlighted the vulnerability of the global economy to disruptions in supply chains, which were primarily triggered after the outbreak of COVID-19 pandemic. For example, the cost of using those shipping containers between Canada and the U.S. has yet to return to pre-pandemic levels. Freight costs are likely to remain high into late 2022. The growing container costs are increasing the prices of goods. In the U.S., there's a shortage of dock workers to unload the ships and a shortage of truck drivers to pick up the cargo once it has finally unloaded.
And I will say we are working it day and night, 7 days a week. You know, my team, the White House, Secretary Buttigieg's team, and we're starting to see incremental improvement. My friend Jim Cramer and I talk all the time about semiconductors. There's a lot of work left to do, and so we are on it. We're putting focus on it. We're making slow improvement, but there's no denying that it's a problem. I think we're going to be feeling these effects for well into 2022, and it is disruptive, and that's why we have to stay focused.
According to analysts, the U.S. and the EU are the most exposed to supply chain disruptions. It is widely believed that solving the crisis will need more ships, additional warehouses, and an influx of truck drivers. But none of that can be solved easily. Many months, and perhaps even more than a year, are likely to transpire before the chaos subsides.
Did you ever wonder why China is called the factory of the world? Let's look at the different ways that China can be given that title. Many companies worldwide have heavy dependence on Chinese factories, since China offers a combination of supply chains and a growing middle class that fuels high demand for almost any good. According to a United Nations report, China is home to almost every industry. That is quite an incredible feat if you think about it. But propping up a factory or company is not the end of the story. Chinese companies offer almost the full range of products and services in each of these industries. There needs to be a differentiation made here when it's said that China is home to almost every industry. Although China may produce or manufacture every product on the planet or close to it, it does not mean that it is supplying the whole world with its products. We will refer to stats from before the pandemic, the year 2019 for this data. According to the United Nations Statistics Division, China accounted for 28.7% of global manufacturing output. It is pretty obvious that China leads the pack by a large margin, especially the US leading it by roughly 12%. So why are we mentioning China's superior capacity in being a manufacturing and production hub of the world? Well, because the supply chain bottleneck was in part due to the reliance that many countries around the world have on China. The real surprise came as to where the bottleneck was occurring in the supply chain crisis: ports in other major parts of the world. And when it comes to looking at turnaround times, Asian countries have the lead, with China at number one, while the US and UK are at the bottom of the list, spending an average 50 to 51 days at the ports in the year 2021. And that does it for this segment. I'm Matty. Until next episode.
The protests in Canada brought to light one important issue: cross-border trade and how it can be targeted, preventing trade and thus incurring losses. At the same time, it pointed out to the bigger problem that exists, and that is the vulnerability of the supply chain access points. If one is offline, then are there enough alternatives in place so that the flow continues? And as far as China goes, it rose to the challenge and made sure that it maintained its top spot as the top manufacturer of the world. Now, given the fact that there are so many countries that buy from China, obviously the saying goes, when China sneezes, the rest of the world catches a cold. But I think it prevented that for the time being. That does it for this edition of the program. It was great having you. From Mikhail Tarway, it's goodbye.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsetodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsetodayEnglish.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. My grandma's home. She has gone shopping to the bazaar. The sound you hear is the sound of a water fountain. My grandma loves Persian gardens a lot, so she has put a small fountain in a corner of the living room. You just need to close your eyes and imagine yourself in the middle of a Persian garden. Before I forget, today we are going to visit the Persian Garden of Tehran. I'm sure you'll like it! Persian gardens are the gardens which are made based on the architecture of Iran's plateau. In Persian literature, Persian garden is referred to as Bagh-sara, Pardis, or Bustan. Persian garden has three structures as well as a unique design. Firstly, it has been located on the pathway of water stream. Secondly, it is surrounded with tall walls. And thirdly, inside the garden, there is a summer mansion and a water pool. Persian gardens are intertwined with the history of emergence of Qanats in Iran. The first Persian gardens were created at the exit route of Qanats, which can be found in the cities of Tabas, Yazd, Gonabad, Birjand, and most desert areas. The Persian Garden of Tehran is an old garden located in Vanak neighborhood. The garden covers 3.5 hectares, with more than 2 hectares of it being green environment. This garden and its mansion belongs to a person called Mirza Hasan Khan Mostofi al-Mamalik. His father was the district of Dehvanakht from Nasiruddin Shah Qajar, and after digging several qanats, made a village out of that area. Currently, this garden, while keeping its original form, has become a spectacular park in Tehran. I am now standing by the Persian Garden of Tehran. This garden has a brick-made meshed entrance. On the ceiling of the entrance, green and blue chandeliers are hanging, This great entrance is hinting us that a wonderful scenery is ahead. Let's go inside. I knew I would see such a spectacular scenery in this garden. Here, there are very old trees which date back to 150 to 250 years ago. Plane trees, cypress trees, elms, locust trees. Oh, that way there are some pomegranate and persimmon trees. And on my right, the neighboring of tall walnut trees with short berry trees has made a very beautiful paradox. And this is a water pool left from the Qajarid era. Oh, how cold the water is! Freezing! I am now standing at the end of the Persian garden. Here, there is a kushk. Kushk is a Farsi word, which is actually the summertime structure of the garden. This kushk has a library, which is suitable for book lovers to come to this calm place and read books in its hall. And in spring and summer, this garden is filled with colorful tulips. In the middle of the sidewalks of the garden, beautiful water streams have been made. Indeed, from any side of the garden which you pass, you can hear the pleasant sound of the water streams. I wish my grandma was here so she could enjoy this beautiful sound. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Almost 2 years after African-American George Floyd died beneath the knee of a white police officer on a street in Minneapolis, the police officers involved are being brought to account. A federal jury has found three former officers present at the scene of Floyd's arrest guilty of depriving the man of his civil rights. The jury found the conduct of the three officers led to Floyd's death, a charge that would impact the final verdict the officers will face. Three are convicted of failing to stop Derek Chauvin, who knelt on Floyd's neck for about 9 minutes, and denying Floyd's constitutional right to medical care while in custody. Tu Tao, Alexander Quang, and Thomas Lane will remain free on bail until their hearings, which aren't scheduled yet. What's for certain is that they'll face several years in prison. Chauvin, the officer arresting Floyd, was sentenced to 22 and a half years last year. For Floyd's family, it's not enough.
This is just accountability. It can never be justice because I can never get George back. And no matter how many times that I pray at night and I think about my brother 24/7, it still is going to be hard, even though we just had a federal conviction and we already had the state conviction. But times, you know, will be probably a lot harder for me still because I can't get my brother back.
The trials are considered historic in the U.S., where officers are hardly ever indicted for the treatment of the members of the black community. Racism in the United States dates back as long as its history. The African Americans have suffered tremendous atrocities at the hands of white slave owners over the years, and the impact it made on American society can be observed to this day. One of the early cases of police racism can be traced back to the early 1700s when South Carolina launched America's first law enforcement force, dubbed the Slave Patrol. As the title suggests, the patrols were tasked with hunting down black people and selling them into slavery. Following a devastating civil war, slavery in the U.S. was abolished in 1865, but the results the anti-slavery camp was looking for didn't come to pass. Wealthy plantation owners in the South found loopholes in the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution and created what later became known as the Black Codes, the rules and regulations that appeared to have acknowledged the abolition but created the same slavery conditions in essence. Among the many racist provisions in the codes is the criminalization of vagrancy for black people. This meant that law enforcement was free to arrest and charge any black person who didn't have a job. The codes were a precursor to Jim Crow laws, which enforced racial segregation in the South and lasted until the mid-20th century. The recent killings and mistreatment of the black people are reminiscent of the lynching of African Americans and the destruction of their properties by the Ku Klux Klan and other hate groups throughout the years.
I guess the main root is, you know, this country has been founded on a system of white supremacy, racism, and genocide. It's founded on a system of inequality with a purpose, right? Racism with a purpose. The purpose is to create a group of second class citizens who the country can feed off of, right? We can feed off of their labor. We can feed off of their work. We can feed off of their existence.
U.S. President Joe Biden staked much of his presidency on a promise to fight racism in the country, managing to garner the support from a large portion of the African-American society. But with many lawmakers balking at even the idea of police reforms, can the president make good on his pledge?
You know, police reform and police brutality is a big issue for black and brown folks and for poor and working class folks here in the United States. But the U.S. politicians don't represent those people or those interests in this country. They represent a rich interest, the rich interest of the ruling class. And so, you know, they're not interested in police reform. So this bill, you know, essentially has died in the Senate and will probably never get passed because of the fact that, you know, there's no interest by U.S. policymakers to get it passed. There's no interest to do what the citizens want them to do.
George Floyd
wasn't the first African-American who lost his life over what could otherwise be considered as an inconsequential offense for a white person, and certainly has not been the last. But the waves of scrutiny such cases bring up in their wake are indeed making a positive, albeit limited, impact.
Vienna's Palais-Cobourg Hotel, the venue of marathon talks between Iran and the P4+1 group. It has once again become the center of a lot of attention, as parties involved in the tough negotiations have signaled significant progress despite the complexity of some issues. The eighth round, which began on December 27th, has now become one of the longest rounds of talks between Iran and the P4+1, namely Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany. Iran and the P4+1 are completing a draft text of an agreement to revive the 2015 deal. Most of the delegations acknowledge that the talks have reached a critical stage. The diplomacy seems to be approaching a make-or-break moment. Iran's lead negotiator says being near the finish line does not guarantee crossing it. Ali Bagheri-Kani says it requires extra caution, much perseverance, additional creativity, and a balanced approach to take the last step. The Iranian diplomat points out that to finish the job, there are certain decisions that the Western parties to the negotiations need to take.
Thus far, the West has been reluctant to make any sweeping political decisions that are necessary to bring the United States back into the plan. Iran isn't just going to forget the very many U.S. and Western provocations since the United States left the plan in 2018, and they understand that there are many political camps competing at once for power. The West needs to make sweeping political decisions that will definitively outline the future of U.S. involvement in the plan.
Iran says its initiatives pave the way for the progress in the negotiations and that a good deal is within reach in the Austrian capital. Tehran believes that the ball is now in the West's court, and if it shows serious determination, a good deal can emerge. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi says Tehran seeks a lasting deal, not a fragile one. The president has noted that credible guarantees, putting an end to political claims and effective removal of sanctions are necessary for a lasting deal with the P4+1 group. But what are the characteristics of a lasting deal? The 2015 deal lasted a few years only. Even during the years that the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action was in place, Iran had serious grievances about its implementation by Western parties. It complained that it was not receiving the economic benefits it was entitled to. And Iran seems to have learned a lesson from how the hard-earned international agreement unraveled. Since the beginning of the talks in Vienna last year, Iran has insisted that America must remove all sanctions imposed on Tehran after former U.S. President Donald Trump unilaterally pulled out from the deal in May 2018 in a verifiable manner. It has also demanded that Washington provide guarantees that it will not leave the JCPOA again.
Iran wants credible guarantees from the United States because the U.S. has failed to provide any critical guarantees, any credible guarantees, since the beginning of these negotiations. When the JCPOA was first being planned and negotiated back in 2015, the United States made a commitment to diplomacy and peace. Yet, in 2018, they proved that that commitment was not a guarantee by dropping out after the change of an administration. So what we find is that when Iran is talking to the United States and other Western nations that change their administrations often in those administrations.
This is a special coverage of a live event.
Well, dear listeners, here we interrupt the normal course of our program to have the live coverage of the speech of the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, on the auspicious occasion of Eid Mab'ath. Let's take a listen.
members of Islamic community
Aziz,
and the endeared and respected people of Iran. And also I congratulate the whole freedom seekers of the world. Well, the day of Jamabath, or the appointment of Muhammad to prophethood, there are days and nights that are the greatest gifts of the world of existence. In the special prayer, it's been mentioned as it's attributed to the Prophet of Islam. He's been regarded as the best creature of the Almighty God. That was a gift awarded to him, of course, by Be'asat, or appointment of the Prophet of Islam. That's actually a gift to the entire humanity as well. If you consider the multitude of virtues and values, the whole range of Islamic values, if you just regard and bear in mind two virtues, that is the element of wisdom and also the element of nurturing of morals. These are the, you know, there's a whole set of Islamic values and virtues, but these two are the outstanding and prominent virtues. If you just bear in mind these two elements and see what huge emphasis Islam has laid upon them, you will affirm that Islam considers the loftiest present to humanity, that that's what is presented to human beings. So it's wisdom and prudence and the propagation of the same thing. This is what Islam is inviting to. That's an important thing. In the Holy Quran, we have tens of verses and tens of cases, maybe close to 100 cases. If you just count those cases, you would see there are different interpretations by saying Ta'avanun or Tadafakun, that means ponder upon or contemplate or words like that. The Almighty God is addressing His servants and massive people to ponder and sit down and think and contemplate. Now, as for moral concepts and nurturing of those concepts, I just suffice to say that among the loftiest goals of the Be'asat, or appointment of Muhammad to prophethood, it's morals that stand on the very top. In several verses in the Holy Quran, it said that we send Prophet Muhammad first. First comes purity and piety. That's mentioned. It's purification. Also, another verse is being cited in Arabic, that we descended upon them, verses of the Holy Quran, to purify their souls. There are some other places, some other verses in the Holy Quran, that the goal of the Be'asat, or prophethood, is called, is actually the purification and purity of soul. These are the two lofty aspirations and virtues that are gifted to mankind. This is what Islam has done, and Islam is insisting on that. And it's also calling upon its believers and consequently the whole masses of people and humanity to turn to wisdom, prudence, and purifying their mind and soul. That's the biggest gift that Islam has bestowed upon humanity. There are a number of points I want to mention regarding the Beset or appointment of the Holy Muhammad to prophethood, and then a number of points regarding that. Developments on a So one point regarding this occasion is when Muhammad was appointed to prophethood, it just helped materialize something that seemed to be impossible. And what was that? The fact that the people residing in the Arab island during the time, the era of ignorance, I will cite their characteristics. From among that people, you know, a virtuous community like the Islamic community came to be and was formed. So it seems that such a thing, when you through average eyes, that seems not to be possible. The people in Arabia before Muhammad was appointed to prophethood, they had certain characteristics mentioned in Nahjul Balagha book and also in his gone down in history. They had gone awry. They were purposeless, and they had no goals in their lives, and they were highly ignorant, and they were beset with large, and, you know, seditions and division that were the result of great ignorance. And despite all these attributes and characteristics, lack of wisdom, knowledge, prudence, and they were devoid of any morsel of moral values, no goals in their lives, no aspirations. And so they were at the same time highly arrogant and ferociously violent. They wouldn't accept others' rights. These are what people were like in Arabia, in the city of Mecca and elsewhere, from top to bottom, everyone, rank and file, and also their elders. These were their characteristics and how they used to be. And so from the same people, the Prophet of Islam turned the same people into a nation during this little span of time that I'll mention. They proved to be a united people. When you look at the Muslims, the Prophet's era, those who were confined to the city of Medina, or when they spread out to Taif and Mecca and elsewhere, they stood united, they were virtuous, they were sacrificial, and they possessed the loftiest virtues, moral values. The very same people with those characteristics were intended to such human beings. So this was this didn't seem to be feasible. I mean, you could never come to a conclusion that in a short span of time such people would turn into totally different people with these virtues. And then in less than 20 years' time, then their fame got spread out. I mean, the very same people with those characteristics, after they embraced Islam, it was less than 20 years, they, you know, the word got around and it became famous, and the reputation got extended to different parts of the world. Their thoughts, their ideas, and their magnanimity were spoken about elsewhere in the world, as we put it these days, both in terms of software and hardware. They underwent huge development. This is what Islam did. And that's truly something that seemed to be impossible. Yet Islam made that happen. This is what the Betha did, the appointment of Muhammad to prophethood. That was the result. So this is what happened in the course of history. Today, we can benefit from this. Well, this is a good tiding. This is a promise for Muslims in the course of history. It's been there, to the fact that any time there is a will of the masses of people, if it's parallel with the divine will, and if it's a function of the divine will, then human beings would be able to do things that would seem to be impossible. They can attain goals and targets that in the eyes of conventional, you know, calculations, they are far-fetched. That's always been so. It's been so in the course of history. The very same prophetic experience could recur. If people stand on that line, they will be able to achieve lofty aspirations that when you look, based on calculations by average man, seem to be impossible. Of course, there are some differences. The same thing with some differences happened to Iranian people. God was kind to the Iranian people and bestowed upon the Iranian people and allowed them to experience almost the same thing. And that was the eradication of we had this absolute monarchy in this country that was ousted. It was a despotic rule that relied on materialistic values and devoid of any kind of spirituality. And it had its roots in history. So, this happened in this country, and what supported this monarchy in this country was the United States and the superpowers in the world. It was the U.S., the U.K., and even recently we had the former Soviet Union that stood in support of the Pahlavi regime. But the Iranian people were able to uproot this monarchical system that seemed to be impossible, that really seemed impossible. So the people did manage to make this happen, and that led by the late Imam Khomeini, and also the resolution on the part of the Iranian people. That's what happened. Well, those days, we were there on the stage and on the forefront and were abreast of everything. And so when we were told that such a thing could happen, then we would take it with a pinch of salt, but it did happen. So this revolution took the people out of their passive mood. It just got them moving. It bestowed upon them some fervor and zeal. It was not only this revolution that portrayed its greatness to the world, it also brought greatness to the Iranian nation, and the Islamic Iran seemed to great in the eyes of the world. So that's the first point. So in case we stand and we move on the path of the Prophet, then we'll be able to do to make possible the impossible, and will be able to achieve goals and aspirations that seem to be inaccessible and unachievable. Now, the next point regarding the appointment of Muhammad to prophethood, the Eid al-Mabas, is that despite the way that some people differentiate between faith and policy. They say these should be segregated, that governance is different from, you know, faith and religion. They got to stand separately. And there are different groups that are working on this, and they've been there since before. And on the back of the revolutionary move, their action was nullified. But still, you see that there are some individuals who are whispering the same thing. They are writing things, they are making speeches to that. And despite what they think, the apex of the prophetic uprising was the formation of a governance system. And the Prophet of Islam himself set the very preliminary stages for that to happen. So with the elderly and the heads of tribes of the city of Medina, they had heard about Islam, and they went there to see what's happening. The Prophet talked to them, negotiated with them, and he signed contracts with them, and agreements, they came to agreements. Of course, at that time, it was not called Medina, it used to be called Yathrib. So he paved the way for that. And then the Prophet of Islam started his migration, and then the Muslims started their migration gradually. Migrants came in before the Hijra or the migration. The Prophet sent an envoy to Yathrib, Ibn Umair, as his envoy. He was sent there to Yathrib, and he recited the verse of the Holy Quran for the people in that city. So he paved the way first, and then the Prophet himself immigrated into Yathrib, and he established and set the foundation of the Islamic governance system there. That was the apex of his prophethood. And he did not suffice to this only by just forming a government system to run the affairs of the people. He didn't stop here. He started to confront the enemies, because the enemies, you know, did not leave Muslims alone. Well, some armies were formed, military equipment were provided. They raided the enemy. They, at times, they defended themselves. At times, they attacked. Yeah, you know, both ways, because sometimes some people say that some prophet of Islam only took part in defensive wars. No, that was not the same thing. Sometimes it was an attack. So it was a counterattack. Then he conquered the base of polytheism. That was the city of Mecca. He conquered that place, and the house of God came to be in the possession of Muslims, and the Islamic governance was stabilized and established there. This is the most exciting and the apex of forming an Islamic governance. So how could these people, you know, say that faith is separate and should be segregated from governance? Now, the other point about that is that one of the most important and major slogans and strategies of the Prophet of Islam was to confront and face ignorance. Well, in the Holy Quran, on multiple occasions, you hear that the ignorance. I'll explain to you what we mean by ignorance. Several times, the Quran has mentioned it, and as it is mentioned in Arabic and Azaf, for example, verse. Also, we have chapter. And several other places in the Holy Book. There are three verses that I had in my mind, and I put it down on paper, and I just mentioned for you. So what is this ignorance that Islam is? It's not only a lack of knowledge. It's there. It's part of it, of course. But by ignorance, you know, it's got a wider definition in Islam. It's also demeaning. It's and also mean morals and attributes. Actually, I mentioned some of them, and also some attitudes, some like thieving, like the aggression, like rape, like oppression, and these were all rampant in Arabia desert at that time. This is also part of ignorance, also sexual deviation, and you know, and immorality. And so lack of respect among the people. And these were all parts of the notion of ignorance when we mentioned that. So, and this is what prophethood came to stand against. I mean, the ignorance which is mentioned in that chapter attributing to prophets' wives, that's such a thing that I just mentioned. It's both lack of knowledge and information and illiteracy, and it's immoral values, discrimination, trampling upon other people's rights, moral decadence, and also sexual issues and deprivation. They are all parts of ignorance. So the Prophet stood against ignorance. And the main point here is the fact that many of those immoral attributes that were rampant in the city of Mecca and the island of Arabia at that time, and against which the Prophet stood, many of those attributes can be seen in today's so-called modern Western world, and they can be seen in a much more organized and much broader scale in today's world. Exactly the very same vicious attributes, and it's even stronger and fiercer. Well, today, living in Western civilization is on the basis of avarice, is on the basis of greed. I mean, the basis of life in the Western civilization is greed and avarice. So the very foundation of all the Western values is money. Money is the yardstick for everything. Morals, spirituality, everything is measured on the basis of money. So the rampant policy, strategies, governance, they all serve discrimination. They all serve the fattening of corporations and cartels. That's how things are today. So knowledge and science at the service of slaughtering people. Technology and science is at the service of taking people's lives. Once they, you can use the science and technology, let's say, to make some vaccine or a certain medicine to save people's lives. But the same knowledge could be used to make weapons of mass destruction, make biological and chemical weapons, atomic bombs, that hundreds of times more people that are saved could be killed by these scientific achievement. That's what happened in the world, and it's still happening. So the looting and plundering of weaker countries, moral decadence, sexual deprivation, and homosexuality. You just feel ashamed of even mentioning them. This is the chaos and this what you see and sexual issues that are rampant in the world today. The very same things that used to be in those times and time and age. It was a limited scale, and now you see them more organized and much more extensive. Many of these corrupt issues, behind them there are some artificial logic. I mean, they seem to have some ideological backing. There is some thought that's fabricated and that's offered to humanity. So ignorance is still there. So if you take a look at today's Western civilization, that's modern ignorance, if you just call us, as many people have called us, modern ignorance, and they are right. This is the very same concept and notion, but in a, let's say, in a renewed way, in a modernized way, it still exists, and you can see that in the world. So what should be done? There are lessons that we need to review from the ordainment of Muhammad to prophethood, what the Prophet of Islam, peace be upon him, did in the face of ignorance in his era. Now it's incumbent upon us to continue and stand against this ignorance. This is our duty. We've got to cement our firm belief and faith. That's what's important for us and all those who sympathize with human beings all over the world. We should enhance our faith-based and religious-based faith. And we should also develop true believers in the world, people who should have some religious incentive, people who are for resilience and for work. They need to be boosted. We should also try to cement the foundations of the Islamic establishment. There is a governance system that it's bearing the flag of Islam, the banner of Islam. That's what you see with the blessing of God happened in Iran. We need to cement that, and we need to boost it to the best of our ability. And then accomplishment achievements, hopefully, could be further. And then we should have this wise planning in place. This is not one of those fields where you can simply close your eyes and attack. You need to study. You need to work. You need to have a wise plan. It should be based on wisdom. So this plan also needs to rely upon the identification or recognition of the attributes of ignorance. If you do not know about this ignorance and what it's all about, you cannot confront it. You cannot fight it. Of course, we cannot claim that in doing such great things, we've achieved our goals and objectives. No, we have taken steps and strides, but we are halfway through. Of course, we have done work. We have made headway, but still we are just halfway through, and we're still distant from our goals. But despite this, and despite the fact that we're still halfway through and we still are distant from our goals, still the pattern of the Islamic revolution for the world people, we are setting an example for world Muslims. It's an attractive example and pattern. Well, you can see just several thousand kilometers from Tehran, elsewhere in another country, there is an insult against our dear martyr Soleimani. And then people show such reaction that police that insulted the picture, the police went there and apologized. And again, they had the photo of General Soleimani on the walls of the city. Again, this is such an attractive pattern. So you see, even we are halfway through, it's still attractive enough. This is an attractive enough pattern for Muslims. If we could tread on this path well, and if we could move things forward strongly and wisely, it could be, we could create such an attractive and fascinating pattern and set an example for the world people to adapt. So this is, we are standing against such ignorance, and of course this modern ignorance is not the same way in different parts of the world. Well, I believe that crystal and a perfect example of modern ignorance is the United States of America. I mean, all over the world, you could see, I mean, compared to elsewhere in the world, you could see this ignorance standing out in the United States, you know, in every sense of the word. I mean, you can say that America is a regime where you see immoral, issues and decadence is spread out and promoted. International wealth moving toward the wealthy and the rich. It's absorbed by the wealthy. I'm in the country as rich as the United States. You can see the situation there where you see it's a little bit colder than usual. Some people die in the streets. When you see it's getting a little hot, and again, some people die on the streets. And what does that mean? Well, this is the manifestation of modern ignorance. That's a manifestation of tyranny, tension-making, and discrimination. This is the epitome of all this, the United States of America. So the region